23-3170 from the Western District of Missouri, United States versus Keith Carnes. Judge, it appears maybe Mr. Coppe has problems. Mr. Coppe, are you still with us?
I'm with us. It just kicked me off.
Okay, but you're back and you can see the timer now?
I'm back and I can see nothing but me right now. And I have a bunch of little squiggles here that I can pin, but no video. So I'm seeing myself right now and no timer.
For the appellate, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, Mr. Janab.
Yes, thank you, Judge.
Okay, very good. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I'm John Janab. I represent appellant Keith Carnes. Mr. Carnes was convicted after a jury trial on a three-count felony indictment. Count one charged him with being a felon in possession of a firearm during a two-week period in August of 2016. Count two charged Mr. Carnes with being a user in possession of a firearm on the same dates for the same firearm. Count three charged Mr. Carnes with being a user in possession of a firearm on a different date, February 10th of 2013. After trial, Mr. Carnes was convicted on all three counts and ultimately received a controlling sentence of 240 months, following which he filed a notice of appeal. On appeal, Mr. Carnes presents three issues. One relates to the sufficiency of the evidence of the user in possession charges, counts two and three. The second issue relates to counts one and two and argues that those counts are multiplicitous. The final issue
I've lost Mr.
Can you hear me?
Okay, we can hear you now. We lost you there momentarily. We're losing him again. Judge Waldman and Judge Kovas, is he frozen on your monitors?
He is for me, Judge Shepard.
Okay. All right, Ms. McKee?
Yes, Judge, I'm going to stop the clock and remove him and have him join again.
Thank you, Your Honor. The parties are in agreement as to the second issue, multiplicity, and we're jointly asking for a remand on that. On the third issue, I do feel that the briefing has set forth the issues for the court's consideration on both sides and would essentially rely on my brief unless the court has questions.
Counsel, can you just remind me, Judge Kovas here, what is your third issue? My chart here has them in a different order. So multiplicity
sure.
Issue you're saying is agreed.
Right.
And the one that you want to rely on your briefs is what?
That's the reasonableness of the sentence that was imposed.
All right. I've got them in a different order. So thank you.
Sure. And so, Your Honors, that leaves the sufficiency argument. And basically, our argument on that is that the government presented evidence of drug use on the day of Mr. Carnes' arrest. With respect to count two, it was on two occasions within that two-week period that I mentioned. With respect to count three, which is really the one I want to focus on, it was only with respect to the day of his arrest on February 10 of 2013. And I would respectfully submit that that evidence is insufficient to sustain a conviction because this court has held that a conviction under the user in possession statute requires a temporal nexus between the possession of the gun and regular drug use, not just drug use on the day of the... Can your honor still hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Thank you. Not just use on the day of his arrest. As the court stated in United States versus Turnbull, that addition of a temporal nexus between the gun possession and regular drug use, frequent regular use, is a necessary one in order to prevent the statute from being unconstitutionally vague. In its brief, the government treats possession on the day of arrest as an alternative that makes it unnecessary to prove repeated or frequent use. And that is based on a fundamentally mistaken premise. They are not...
Judge Kobus here, didn't your client admit, though, to frequent drug use? Or am I misunderstanding or misstating the record?
No, you're absolutely correct. As Mr. Coppe pointed out in his brief, he was asked on cross-examination whether he frequently used marijuana, and he said yes. What was missing from that question and answer was any time frame. He got...
Well, but we have a time frame in the sense that we know he was using at the time of the arrest, right? And then we have a background admission that he used frequently. So if you add those two together, why isn't that enough?
That's a great question, Judge. My response would be that these two incidents were separated in time by so much that you can't say using on February 10 of 2013 and using on August 16th of 2016 is frequent or regular use. Those are 3.5 years apart. Now,
he was just generally a frequent user, or am I wrong on that, right? I mean, and he didn't qualify it as far as, well, 2 years ago I used to smoke weed, but now I don't. He just said, I'm a frequent drug user.
He did. You are absolutely correct. My take on that, okay, is he offered his testimony in November of 2019, right? One of these incidents occurred in August of 2016, the other in February of 2013. Can we really say that a statement in November of 2019 that is in no way qualified, he says, I use marijuana frequently, can we really relate that all the way back to say that on February 10 of 2013, he was a regular user?
Well, was there evidence of drug use in 2013 at the time of the arrest?
No. The only evidence was that he was, at the time of his arrest, he was under the influence of marijuana.
Well, at the time of what arrest? In 2013?
Of the 2013 arrest. Yes.
So he was using in 2013.
Yes, on that date. And yes, absolutely. He was using on that date. He admitted it to the police and he failed field sobriety tests. So the my point, Judge, is that on February 10 of 2013, the government's burden as to that date was to show that as of that date, he was a regular user and a frequent user in around that date, right? And my point, or my argument anyway, is that as to February 10 of 2013, the only evidence was use on that specific date. That's pretty much my argument. And Judge, I think with respect to the need for that, I've laid out in the briefs multiple circuits, every one of which agrees that the requirement is that there be proof of regular, not just one time, but regular use prior to and up to the time of the possession of the firearm. And that's pretty much, unless the court has other questions, that's pretty much what I wanted to say, and I'd be happy to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Coppy for the government.
Phil, you're muted.
All right, my bad. Not having a great day already. My name is Phil Coppy, and I represent the government in this case. Thank you for that. In reviewing my brief this morning, I was left with the question of how we ended up convicting him, too. But that's only because I see I left out some sentences in my statement of facts where he actually possesses the firearm. I'll send a letter to the court that somehow three sentences got dropped out of my brief, so it would appear that in one of the instances he didn't have a weapon at all. But it is in my argument. The other thing I wanted to start out with is I do agree with Mr. Janab. We have a problem here under his argument two. As we indicate in our brief, we should have two sentences and two terms of supervised release, not three terms of supervised release. And so I think we're in agreement that the judgment in this case needs to be amended. With respect to the sentencing, since Mr. Janab has submitted that on the brief.
Does the government, appellant said the matter needs to be remanded for the district court to take care of this. You agree
right, but I don't think a resentencing is necessary. I think the court can simply correct the judgment. I don't know if Mr. Janab agrees, but I think that's the correct remedy here.
Okay, proceed.
All right, and with respect to the sentencing issue, since Mr. Janab submitted that on the brief, unless the court has any questions, I will confine my argument to the first argument. We start with the unassailable proposition that it is illegal for an unlawful user of a controlled substance to possess a firearm. As we point out in our brief, the government is not required to prove that the defendant possessed the firearm while contemporaneously using a controlled substance. It's sufficient for the government to demonstrate that the use of the controlled substance during the period of time that the defendant possessed the weapon or firearm, not that there was actual use at the time the officers discovered the possession of the firearms.
Counsel, let me just jump to it. In 2013... was there use at the time of the possession or not?
Yes, there was.
So yes, is the government's argument that that's sufficient in and of itself?
Well, our argument is yes, that if you look at the instruction that the jury was submitted, it basically says, I mean, before I go any further, let me say that we have argued, of course, that we have more than that.
Get into trouble this evening. I happen to have a firearm under my front seat, and I happen to run into someone and smoke some marijuana and drive home and am caught. Is that sufficient for conviction under the statute if I have marijuana in my system and a firearm in my possession?
Well, yes. I think that avoids any possibility of vagueness.
Even assuming it's my first time I've ever used it.
Our argument, Judge, and I understand what you're saying, but our argument would be that if you choose to use illegal drugs, then get rid of your weapons. Do not have those weapons.
And what is the statutory language there?
Pardon?
Is it a regular user? What is the statutory language here?
Well, the statutory language just says user, And what I was relying on, if you look at page 20 of the government's brief, what we're relying on is the instruction. Before I go any further, I know what the court will often say. Well, these are approved instructions, but we didn't approve them. They're just patterned instructions. However, if you look at the Turnbull case and you look at the instruction that they approved in that case, it is very similar to what we have here. And I think this is where our argument rests, Judge. It says the phrase unlawful user of a controlled substance means a person who uses a controlled substance in a manner other than prescribed by a licensed physician. So in your hypothetical, is he using it? He is. Now, it may be his first time, but he's using it. The second sentence says the defendant must have been actively engaged in use of a controlled substance during the time he possessed the firearm, but the law does not require that he use the controlled substance at the precise time. Well, guess what? We have one of those rare instances where he is using the firearm, using the drugs at the precise time. And he does this in both instances. It seems to me that this individual is precisely the person that Congress was aiming at when it passed the statute. Now, the part of the regular use comes in because normally we don't have this kind of evidence. We don't have evidence the guy is actually under the influence and he's got a weapon. Usually it's different. He may have been using a few days earlier or a few days later, or maybe they find some drugs in his car, and so they basically have to go back and make a case. Now, before I get any further, one of the things that's interesting about this case, and I don't blame Mr. Janoff for raising the argument, but this was never contested at trial. You can read the three or four pages of closing argument, and I'm not sure what the defense was arguing here. They assumed, I think correctly, that the defendant had testified his way out of any kind of defense here, since he said, and again, he regularly used, or I think the word was frequently. And with respect to the time frame that we're talking about, I mean, he's being asked about, you know, he's been charged with conviction or crimes that occurred in 2013 and 2016, and that's what he's being questioned about. So when he says, yeah, I frequently used, and then he went on to say, yeah, and when the police stop me and I have marijuana in my possession, they usually just step on it. They don't arrest me. So we have the additional evidence that we need. We have two instances, both the same, where he's driving vehicles, he's got drugs in the car, and he's under the influence. So we don't have to base it simply on one, and we don't have to simply base this on, but my argument here is, or our argument is that in this sort of narrow situation where we rarely see, it fits. Such use is not limited to the drugs on a particular day or within a matter of days or weeks before trial, but rather the unlawful use has occurred recently enough to indicate that the defendant is actively engaged in such conduct. And obviously he was actively engaged in possessing marijuana because he had it in his system and he had it in his car. Now, the instruction goes on to say that an inference that the person was a user of a controlled substance may be drawn from evidence of a pattern of use or possession of a controlled substance that reasonably covers the time period the firearm was possessed. So they're basically saying, okay, if you don't have what we have, then this is how you can prove it. But what we have here was he's under the influence. That's not disputed. He has the firearm. That's not disputed. Now, if the court has looked at the PSR in connection with the sentencing arguments, you'll note that it's replete with evidence that this defendant has been using drugs forever. We could have put that on. I think the AUSA, who was in charge of this, was fearful of gilding the lily here, thinking that we had plenty. But if you look at that, you can see that he had, a drug conviction that goes back, possession back in 2000 and... back when he was 17 years old. That evidence, of course, that I'm referring to that's in the PSR, most of it is not in the record. Because again, the question of whether he was a drug user wasn't really an issue. I mean, not a contested issue. It was an issue, obviously. Wasn't a contested issue. So our argument here is that under the existing case law, we do have the other evidence, if that, in fact, is what we need here. But I think our threshold position is in situations where you have someone here who on two occasions is caught under the influence with drugs and with a gun, that seems to me that that's precisely the sort of conduct that Congress targeted. And the argument that, well, no, it's not enough. We've got to show that he's a regular drug user. Well, you know, this guy is more dangerous than somebody who maybe used last week and the week before that. I mean, this guy is obviously a threat. And we found out exactly what happened with respect to when he was fleeing. It's hard to believe that his being intoxicated on drugs didn't result or have something to do, rather, with the fact that that ended up in a vehicular homicide. So the whole purpose behind the statute, it seems to me, is to ensure that people who are actively using drugs don't have a firearm in their possession, and this individual is just such an individual. And so when you have these cases that say, well, you need regular drug use, they're not cases like this where you have an individual who both has the firearm, has the drugs, is under the influence, and is caught, you know, at the scene. I'm sorry.
Does the word regular appear in the statute or in the instructions? Regular come from?
Judge, it comes from case law, which I submit are not in point. Yes, it's not in the instruction. That's the point, and it's not in the statute. The regular comes in because the court has said, and I think it's in instances where you don't have simultaneous possession. It's like, in order to make this statute not vague, we have to have some sort of temporal nexus. That's what the cases say. You need a temporal nexus, and so it's got to be, can't be too remote. But our argument here is that we have the temporal nexus. We have them right on top of each other. We have them at the same time. We shouldn't have to go back and say, well, okay, can we prove that he used last week, or can we prove that he used last month? I mean, we know he was possessing. We know he was using. That can't possibly be vague as to him. But, you know, I admit I do not have a case which involves this exact situation where the court has said exactly what I want. I'm relying essentially on the fact that this instruction that we set out at page 20 of our brief was approved by the court in Turnbull, or a very similar version, rather, and that it doesn't require regular drug use. It basically says, what it says we don't have to show is we don't have to show that he used the controlled substance at the precise time. And here we have the precise time. So we prove more than the instruction requires. Yes, Judge.
So the hiatus, as it were, between the events is irrelevant in your analysis of this case.
Well, it's not irrelevant, but I'm arguing that it's not. It doesn't hurt us. I mean, there's a hiatus of like 3 years, but you know, he's doing something. The reason that it doesn't is we've got two separate occasions. They are 3 years apart, but then when you add to the fact that, you know, he said, I'm a frequent user. He admitted that he was a frequent user of marijuana. He admitted that, you know, he got stopped by police and they would stomp on it and take it away from him. I'm saying that certainly, in its totality, the jury could infer based on multiple innocence. And remember, it's all inferences that are derived in, you know, are in favor of the government, in favor of the conviction. So it's not that the time frame is irrelevant. It's that it isn't dispositive in the sense that, well, it's too far apart. And when Mr. Jobs says, well, we don't know what time frame he was talking about, again, he was being questioned about incidents that occurred in 2013 and 2016, and he said, yeah, I was using marijuana. So if we needed evidence of other use, I think we have it here. I see we have 1:40 left on the clock, and I don't need to use all my time unless there are questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coppe. Mr. Janab, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, the hypothetical that was posed of a law-abiding citizen who happens to use marijuana one time and is in possession of a firearm, there is absolutely no doubt that that person is not covered by the statute. And the reason for that is because of the judicial gloss that has been applied to the statute for that precise reason, to avoid a vagueness problem. And what the courts have done unanimously, every appellate court that has considered the issue, has been to say that the requirement for proof under this statute is that there must be regular use. It must go on.
Counsel, doesn't the vagueness issue come up when the use doesn't coincide with the possession? In other words, the vagueness is a user and whether there's temporal proximity to the possession. But if I'm using when I'm caught with a gun, that issue, the vagueness there goes away, doesn't it?
It doesn't, according to the case law, Judge. According to the cases that I've cited, which all of them pretty much say exactly the same thing, that the group, the term unlawful user, is a status element. I mean, you have to belong to that group of people. The case law says that you don't
become... Well, the first time I ingest marijuana, I'm a user, right?
By you have used, okay?
I have used, but I'm not a user?
Right, exactly. What the courts are saying is an unlawful user is a person here.
Isn't that a person who's using unlawfully?
Well, let me quote U.S. v. Cook, okay? The Seventh Circuit case from 2020 that I cite in my brief. And what the court says in that case is unlawful use of a drug entails one, use other than as lawfully prescribed by a physician. Okay, so that would be you using one time. But also, two, use that was both regular and ongoing.
But did that case involve a positive test and possession at the time of possession of the firearm?
No.
Why isn't that important here? I mean, it seems fairly obvious to me as a matter of just pure interpretation of words here that if I'm smoking weed, I'm a user of an unlawful controlled substance.
The term is unlawful user, all right? The way that the courts have defined that term is to say that an unlawful user has to be someone who has used enough, okay? They've had enough use.
But those cases don't deal with possession or use at the time of possession. That's the bridge that courts use when you don't have the temporal proximity. In this case, we do on two occasions. And I don't want to belabor the point, but that's what I struggle with in this case. I understand those cases, but this may be what the government suggests, and it's one of those unusual cases where you don't have to prove that because you caught him red-handed.
Judge, I definitely understand what you're saying. I will say that, at least in my research, not only has there never been a conviction affirmed where there was only proof of one-time use, but there has never been a suggestion in any of these appellate cases that that would suffice. I think the whole rationale of the court's rulings is that that doesn't suffice. That there does have to be regular use before a person can be deemed to have notice that they fall within the class of persons prohibited under this subdivision of the statute. And that's our position.
In other words, under your analysis, everyone is entitled to one free, as it were, use?
Yes, and in fact, maybe more than one, Judge. For purposes of being a felon for having a firearm. Doesn't mean they're entitled to a free use for purposes of the drug laws.
And of course, the frequency or the use aspect involving a firearm is that it connotes the increased dangerousness of a person of that nature.
Correct.
Or of that of drug habit in nature.
Correct. Yes. Of addicted.
In other words,
individuals. Right.
Well, Mr. Janab, this was a jury trial, correct?
Correct.
And the appellant testified.
That's right.
And yeah. I thought I understood that he testified as to his use on another occasion, at least one other occasion.
He admitted in his testimony that he used on the 2013 occasion. He admitted that he used on the 2016 occasion, and he testified with no time reference that he was a frequent user of marijuana.
Okay, why doesn't his own testimony supply the necessary proof? And I'm thinking about the Turnbull case where there was proof of use on two occasions, which was found sufficient.
The reason that it doesn't qualify, Judge, is that the two instances here were 3.5 years apart, and the testimony about frequent use was not given any time frame at all.
Okay.
Now, in Turnbull, I would just note, if I could, real quickly, that person admitted to a time frame. He admitted using methamphetamine for a year prior to his possession when he was charged, and also to becoming high a couple of times within the same week that the firearms were found in his home. So I do think that significantly distinguishes the case.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will render a decision in due course.